On what basis have some Christians concluded that the Old Testament represents the Old Covenant and the New Testament the New Covenant? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm your host, Alden Thompson. My conversation partners are Dave Thomas from the Walla Walla University School of Theology and Joe Galosha, Professor of Biology. Now, let me just dump that question out to you two men. Why have some people concluded that, I mean, it's a very easy distinction, Old Testament, Old Covenant, New Testament, New Covenant. Problem solved.
I don't know. I guess it's just a historical precedent. And it's probably for the reason you say is that people look at the covenant as it was written in Sinai and see that it's the old one, but then it talks about making a new covenant, so they assume that's later on in the New Testament. Mm-hmm.
See, and I agree with Dave right there, because my own impression is that the Old Testament describes the older covenant, and that the way one was saved under that was somehow far greater involved in specific actions or behaviors that were taken, often related to the tabernacle. So I spend a lot of time with the Old Covenant and the tabernacle service and all the details, whereas the New Covenant for me is simpler and plainer in the invitation of Jesus to believe and follow me. That's how it seems to boil down for me. And so I am not so puzzled by the old and the new, but I'm looking at them rather simplistically.
Okay, let me just point out a few things that complicate matters. First of all, you don't have any sanctuary service until you get to the wilderness wandering. In other words, you have all the patriarchs, all those things, no sanctuary service. Okay. Then you get to the land of Canaan, and things are very erratic. Even when David and Solomon were there, you have David taking the ark to Jerusalem, and the rest of the things stay at Gibeon. So this idealized picture of an orderly service where you go and you offer your sacrifices and everything is taken care of, that simply doesn't work. And then Israel was taken captive in 586. You have no temple at all. So how does that nice, tidy service, and then when you come up with the fact, if you look at the Old Testament, there is almost no interest in individual salvation. It's all corporal and communal.
But see, my sense of what Joe's talking about is not tied so much to the tabernacle or the sanctuary. It's tied more to the covenant that's made in Deuteronomy, then 28 to 32. You know, that has all that list of blessings and curses. Mm-hmm. And if you behave according to the stipulation of the covenant, you'll be blessed. If not, you'll be cursed.
Okay. That works on a national basis, but as the book of Job indicates, it doesn't work on an individual basis.
Yeah, well, I was thinking of it on a national basis.
National basis. Yeah.
But it didn't work very well that way either.
No, it didn't work at all. In fact, Israel is kind of dumb. So,
but see, I think the root of this, though, is the statement in the Bible about I will make a new covenant.
Good. And where is that passage found?
Isn't one of them in Jeremiah?
One is in Jeremiah. And we need to keep in mind that the new covenant promise is not simply in the New Testament. Now, Hebrews quotes it, but it is, first of all, in the Old Testament, and it is a promise made to Old Testament people living at that time. Let me read it to you. Jeremiah 31, beginning with verse 31. The days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant that I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, a covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, says the Lord. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my law within them, and I will write it on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. No longer shall they teach one another or say to each other, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, says the Lord, for I will forgive their iniquity and remember their sin no more. Now, as a rebel, That's one of my favorite passages. I hate to be told what to do. The dean can recognize that. Yeah. I don't want to be told what to do. This tells me the time that God's law is going to be within me. Nobody's going to teach me. Nobody's going to say, know the Lord. Why? Because he has become so much a part of my experience.
But Alden, you know, Joe has several times during this quarter talked about the heart as opposed to the exterior elements. And don't you think this has always been the case, that when a person comes to faith in God, that there is a softening of their rebellious attitude against God and the things of God? And isn't it for this reason? Wouldn't that be true also at Sinai?
What do you mean? Unpack that a bit.
Well, I mean, did people not have a heart experience at Sinai? Apparently not. I mean, what are we saying here? Was there any transformation of human hearts at the Exodus, or were they merely a group of people who did not understand that dynamic and so had to have a lot of rules laid down for them?
Well, if you need rules, you don't see those rules as being oppressive. You see them to be very helpful. We already read Deuteronomy 4. Wow, somebody's shown us how to live. Now, there's a phrase which I have used, and I don't know whether this is helpful for you, but it comes back to why I obey or why I should obey. There's a powerful impulse in human beings, in sinful human beings, to think that if we obey, we can earn God's favor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty deadly. It leads to the Pharisee on the corner, I thank God that I'm not like other men. See, and so instead of gratitude, it's arrogance. See. So how is it possible that one obeys, one follows God's law out of gratitude rather than out of a tendency to try to earn God's favor? I've used the phrase, grace before law. Now, typically in evangelical circles, it's law hammers you down, and then grace comes along and rescues you. Given that, says it's very difficult to see law as good news, because it's the one that condemns you. You feel condemned by it, see. But if you look at, and there are two famous passages here. Well, one story in the Old Testament, then a famous passage in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, if you look at the sequence, did Israel deserve to be delivered from Egypt?
No.
They were kicking against the pricks the whole time. Only when they had experienced God's salvation were they able to come to Sinai, and now they were ready to listen as part of God's gracious activity on their behalf, because their lives had been touched by grace. Grace brought them to the place where they could even see law now as a gracious guide. Now let's go to Romans chapter 6, and I think it's amazing this comes in Romans, because Paul is usually seen in Romans as being having quite a different perspective. But notice how grace comes before law here in this famous passage, Romans 5, 6 to 11. For while we were still weak, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. Then on a few lines, God proves his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And another one, if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son. In each of those cases, we were still shaking our fists in God's face, but Christ died for us. So grace comes first and touches us, and then we can see whatever counsel God is giving us is for our best good. Now, does that make sense?
I'm puzzled, though, by the Old Testament contrast, because what it appears to me happened then was that the corporate body of Israel would kind of become oriented toward God a little bit. They would behave differently. They would worship the right God in the right way, and they were blessed. And then they seemed to slip away regularly. So it appeared to me that God's blessing was associated with changes in their behavior, and that ebbed and flowed accordingly. So here God would disturb them. They would change their behavior, and then they were blessed and then slip away. And that looks to me to be different than God being nice to them first and they saying, oh, we are so grateful. Let's behave ourselves. It looked to me as though God comes along and chastens and uses a bit of stick. And I need you to help me with that, because it looks to me as though there was considerable change in their behavior before there was blessing and security by God in the Old Testament.
Let's look at the record of the leaders, both during the judges and during the kings. It's very painful. When you have a good judge, what do the people do? They follow God. When you have a bad judge, what happens? The people turn away from God. When you have a good king, the people follow. When you have a bad king, the people follow. In an authoritarian system, you never learn the new covenant promise where it is written on the soul. And that's one of the curious things about Job, one of the beautiful things about Job. God says you can beat up on him all you want. He'll still hold fast to his faith. See? Now, Job is a very troublesome book. It divides my students right down the middle. Some people enjoy a challenge. I'm one of those. So the book of Job doesn't trouble me at all. But my wife, for example, says, why in the world did God have to point him out? Why not just leave the poor man alone? See?
I agree. I'm not sure I would want to be Job very long.
But see, Alden, to go back to the passage in Romans, see what you point at, it seems to me that you could ask the question how soon we knew about the grace of God. You know, certainly God had to act for us while we were sinners and rebels, otherwise there would be no prospect of redemption. But that's not transformative until you know about it.
That's right.
And so, you know, if you ask who knew, I think that our rebellion always precedes grace. We are rescued by grace.
But you go back to the Old Testament. What did Israel expect? And again, did they deserve it? See?
But let me see if I understand what the two of you are looking at from various
sides. Our time's going to run out here soon, Joe, so you need to speak with clarity and with speed.
I'll simply say, what comes first? The behavior and the observation of what needs change. In other words, you got to know that something needs changing, or the solution.
Let me just take these last few minutes to say, in my experience, when I sense the graciousness of God, something that I don't deserve, that has a powerful motivating influence on me.
And when I realized the brokenness that sin brings, it had a powerful humbling experience on me, effect.
We'll respond in different ways, but either way you look at it, it is the grace of God at work. I'm a very hard-driving, competitive, arrogant person. It would be the easiest thing in the world for me when I do something good to pat myself on the back and say, wow, I really did it well. See, but to be able to give God credit and say, this is God at work, that's really quite a different thing. And I think that's something which we really need to, if we're going to really reflect Jesus who gave everything, that's really what we need to do. But our time is up. Next week, we're going to be talking about the apostles and law. And Dave and Joe will be my conversation partners again. My thanks to Chad Ofterhauer, our program engineer, to all of you for listening in. For the good word, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.